Next, James Fleming edits the week's news on Voices and Events, the program that covers the world to bring the voices and sounds in this week's news. You'll hear General MacArthur, General Ridgway, the Duke of Windsor, Charles E. Wilson, Hollywood on the stand, and the voice of a man who found freedom. New techniques of reporting and recording pioneered by the NBC Newsroom make possible this living history. Now the editor of Voices and Events, James Fleming.
It was just 14 months ago that we broadcast a frightening courtroom scene.
I am sincerely sorry for the subversive activities that I carried out against the people's democracy of Hungary.
This is American businessman Robert Vogler as he stood before a communist court in Budapest well over a year ago.
Magyar népi demokrácia ellen kifejtettem.
I gave my testimony freely and openly.
The familiar litany of a communist trial, and Robert Vogler was sent to jail for espionage.
Oh, not maltreatment.
Today, Robert Vogler is with his family in Vienna, a free man after long negotiations by our State Department. At long last, this victim of communism has been freed, a tired and broken man. Across the world in Korea, United Nations forces are fighting tonight, fighting bitterly to free a whole nation from the threat of red domination. It's a hard fight.
The Banzai, that hill, that's what they call Banzai counterattack. We run down the ridge, run up the hill. Artillery started throwing artillery down below the hill, flares, mortars, because we could hear them hollering at night. Giving signals, hollering signals, a hoot owl call. So one of the boys, a new guy, pretty new guy, he was in the hole with one of the old guys, his own guard. And so this new guy, he saw him coming, he didn't know what to do. So he woke this old guy up, and he says, "What shall I do?" And so this old guy said, "Give me that rifle, I'll show you what to do."
The enemy's already suffered an estimated 70,000 casualties. But at this hour, the siege of Seoul is on, and UN forces retreat to new defensive positions. As before, there's the tragic flight of Korean refugees. These are Korean children, orphans most of them. South of Seoul, a teacher is holding an outdoor classroom in the midst of war. No books here. Just the words of the teacher and her echoing students. Suddenly, these words are drowned as jet planes sweep overhead on the way to the front. Yes, in Korea, as General Ridgway noted, these are days of decision. As Supreme Commander, he faces grave and urgent tasks.
I am fully alive to the tremendous responsibilities which have just become mine. With God's guidance and with all my heart and mind, I shall do my utmost to discharge those well.
Last week, the words of another general, General MacArthur, the former Supreme Commander, were broadcast to Korea over the Armed Forces radio. And the band of the Eighth Army went on the air soon thereafter with that now celebrated Old Barracks Ballad. This was the actual broadcast in Korea.
Forces Radio Service, serving the fighting forces of the United Nations.
That was Korea. This week, General MacArthur was welcomed in Chicago and Milwaukee. And again, he raised the question,
what is our policy in Korea?
In this time of national debate, when the issues are of such grave import, let's listen for a moment to the words of a noted editor. This week at radio's Peabody Award ceremonies, Edward Weeks of the Atlantic Monthly made a plea for restraint.
When we disagree, we get angry. And when we get angry, we accuse. Now, I often used to disagree with my father-in-law, who could irritate me more quickly than any man I have ever met in life. In my arguments with him, I used to call him, aloud or under my breath, a Philistine, a diehard, and when he refused to read books or articles in the Atlantic, I wanted him to read a dumbbell. But it never occurred to me to call him a Benedict Arnold or a traitor, because I knew that even though we differed, he was just as passionately and just as truly an American as I was. I hate this habit of labeling with words like appeaser and traitor the people with whom we disagree. Watch it.
That same theme was pursued by Democratic Senator Fulbright on behalf of the administration.
My paths have never crossed those of General MacArthur. And as you know, they have seldom crossed those of President Truman. For a long time, we've been walking on opposite sides of the street, neither of us nodding to the other. He's often thought me wrong and unspeakable, while I have sometimes thought him wrong and incomprehensible. But I do have a real sympathy for him in the awful responsibility which he alone must carry. Mr. Truman remains the president, and in these terrible times, I submit that it is necessary for us to keep him in perspective. Let us not permit his occasional lapses of speech or temperament, or his misguided loyalty to unworthy friends, endanger a calm and objective judgment on the present controversy.
Also on the administration side, Senator McMahon called this week for priority for Europe, warned of our unpreparedness for all-out war and the danger of atomic attack, and he added,
"Now it strikes me that those who would counsel a course of action which would precipitate an all-out war in the East would be doing a grave disservice to the cause of the United States, its survival, and of all mankind. I believe that we should continue in Korea as the lesser evil, the continuation of a war of attrition so that we may carry out the fundamental purpose for that which we went in there. I warn that it may be that we will be faced with all-out war in Asia by the actions of the communists, both Russian and Chinese. But if they do bring about that kind of a situation, they will have started World War III, and we will have not done so."
Harold Stassen thinks the president and the generals should meet face-to-face and settle their differences. Well, this week in Chicago and Milwaukee, General MacArthur received receptions to match those of Washington, New York, and San Francisco. And to a vast audience at Chicago's Soldiers Field, he asked again,
"What is our policy in Korea? Some will tell you that the pacification and unification of all Korea is the objective. Others tend to overlook such a formally stated policy and will tell you that our objective is achieved upon clearing South Korea of invading forces. Still others ignore both explanations and frankly say that our objective now is to continue to engage the enemy forces in Korea in a prolonged and indecisive campaign of attrition, notwithstanding the constantly increasing cost in American blood. The tragedy is that since the advent of the war with Red China, there has been no definition of the political policy which would provide a solution for the new problems thereby created. This has resulted in a policy vacuum heretofore unknown to war. The fundamental question still remains the same. What is the policy for Korea?
For those who have called for a political future for MacArthur, the general repeated a conviction to that Chicago audience.
Although my public life is now closed, and I no longer... It is cold.
And the next day, speaking in Milwaukee, the general said this.
It was 52 years ago that Milwaukee sent me forth into the military service. And I now report to you that service is ended.
And at week's end, General MacArthur and his famous family were back in New York at the Waldorf Astoria. One of his neighbors there is former President Herbert Hoover. Mr. Hoover, contemplating the new national debate, told newsmen he saw no reason for Uncle Joe to enjoy any satisfaction from the sound and fury. This country, said Mr. Hoover, has a habit of closing ranks with a solidarity and a punch that is final. And Charles E. Wilson, mobilization chief, spoke in similar vein, as he pointed out that we're on the way to doubling the defense output of World War II. There would be more controls. Mr. Wilson would stay on the job.
I read the other day in a New York Financial Daily an article quoting some gossip or scuttlebutt to the effect that I am going to quit. There is nothing to it. I have no intention of quitting.
And Mr. Wilson was off to Europe to check on the resources of some of our allies, with particular attention to Britain, where shortages of raw materials are causing production headaches. There was political news from Britain, too, this week, and we'll hear about that in a moment. But now let's leave the events of today and take a look backward to some quieter times. A look through the eyes of a man who intimately lived with history. The Duke of Windsor has just published his memoirs, A King's Story. This week, in an interview with NBC's news director, Henry Cassidy, the former monarch reminisced, first of another century, and a queen whose name was Victoria.
The first 7 years of my childhood were spent during the reign of my great-grandmother, Queen Victoria. As a matter of fact, she dandled me on her knee. When I was born, Queen Victoria was 75 years old, but I can still remember being taken to see her when I was quite small. She wore a white tulle cap, a black satin dress, and shiny black shoes with elastic sides. She was so truly regal that even her own family stood in awe of her. To us children, though she was always Gan-Gan, a childish rendering of the word great-grandmama, I shall always remember the way she took her breakfast at Windsor, Osborne or Balmoral. If the day were fine, she always breakfasted in one of the little wooden huts, of which there were several in the grounds of each of these three places. These wooden huts were mounted on turntables so that they could be faced away from the wind. When the Queen came downstairs, she would find waiting at the front door a small, low-slung carriage with a Highland attendant wearing a kilt to lead the pony. In this vehicle, she rode out to breakfast, which always began with a bowl of steaming hot porridge. Then, when she had finished, she would call for her private secretary and begin dealing with affairs of state.
And here's the Duke of Windsor with some memories of his illustrious father, King George V.
My father's outlook upon the world, his manners and customs, were fundamentally Victorian. Nevertheless, I do not think it would be entirely fair to say that he rejected the less formal ways of the 1920s. Like a general fighting a rearguard action, he simply held them at bay for as long as he could. Many a time I heard him murmur to himself, "Well, we never did that in the olden days." The things my father found wrong with the first post-war world would have made a long list, at the head of which certainly was the new woman, with her bobbed hair and short skirts. He also disapproved of Soviet Russia, cocktails, jazz, and the new habit of going away for weekends. If my father was somewhat old-fashioned and applauded many of the changes that were hailed by my generation, yet he gave ground to many of them with good grace, and even a sense of humor. He was, in fact, highly successful in his reign in adapting the British monarchy to the new conditions.
there have been many stories about the famous abdication speech which marked an end to the brief reign of young King Edward. Did Winston Churchill write it? Again, the Duke of Windsor.
Many believed that it was composed for me by Mr. Winston Churchill. Well, I shall now tell you how that farewell message was written. The first drafts I prepared myself. The afternoon of that last day, Mr. Churchill motored to the fort to lunch with me. He had so often helped me with speeches before that I asked him to read over this last and, for me, crucially important effort. He made some suggestions and supplied some telling and eloquent phrases.
Your description of the scene as Mr. Churchill took his leave of you is extremely moving. I like to think of him standing at your door with tears in his eyes, his hat in one hand, his cane in the other, memoring the famous lines from Andrew Marvel's ode on the beheading of King Charles I. He nothing common did or mean upon that memorable scene.
Yes, you could always count upon Mr. Churchill to grasp intuitively the historical drama of any situation.
Looking back upon it also, if you had to face the same situation today, would you make the same decision again?
Happily, a monarch has to make only one such decision in his life. I should not like to go through again the mental and spiritual anguish that I had to endure in December 1936. But for myself, I have no regrets. In my marriage, I have found a contentment that I never knew before. I am a happy man, and in my brother, Great Britain has a fine king.
That was the Duke of Windsor and part of a king's story, an intimate glimpse of a Britain of another day. Well, this week in London, the news was of politics, of a left-wing revolt within Mr. Attlee's Labour cabinet. Minister of Labour and National Service, Sir Nyren Bevan, resigned, and this was the scene as he gave his reasons to the House of Commons.
The packed House listened to the speech in a tense silence, broken only by occasional low murmurs of approval or dissent. It was, in every sense, a highly dramatic occasion. Mr. Bevan began quietly, hands clasped behind his back, but many subsequent passages were delivered with the passion and forcefulness that have always characterized his oratory.
Bevan had resigned to protest the British government's program of defense before social services. There were those who said that he was looking to future leadership of the Labour Party, that he resigned in anticipation of an early Conservative election victory. In fact, Winston Churchill has canceled his trip to this country in the prospect of a British election. Left-winger Bevan is a persuasive speaker and has a minority following within Labour who listen to his Welsh accents with approval.
What we all know is that there is something that causes a party to be of the way it does. Not only something that explains why it ticks, but also why it ticks in a certain way. If we can understand that, then we know most things about a party that are worth knowing. The first thing to remember about the Labour Party is that it is a product of the 20th century. The Labour Party is a child of today. Its moods, attitudes, aptitudes, and its faults are those of 20th century British society.
And Aaron Bevan is spokesman for those Britons who claim that their Foreign Office is an instrument of the American State Department. He's a leader of what might be called the left-wing British firsters. But the Labour Party, led by Attlee and Morrison, has set its course. Here's how Defense Minister Shinwell puts it.
Though we must delay for a while many of the improvements we had planned, we are determined that our achievements and our traditional freedoms shall be defended with all the vigor with which we fought our enemies from 1939. The charge which is sometimes heard that we are anxious to appease is nonsense. It can be instantly refuted by a glance at what we have done and are doing to resist communist expansion.
Despite our common aims, though, the tensions between Britain and America were growing. And this week, Foreign Minister Morrison tried good humor as he discussed our various national habits.
I always think that the pattern of American democracy is that every American citizen is free to say what he jolly well likes about not only every other American citizen, but every other citizen among the thousands of millions that exist all over the world. And he says it. But I hope we shall always be able to have these franknesses of expression and even differences of opinion between us. Doesn't hurt. Your American democracy asserts the right of every man to speak up. Well, I beg to remind you that so does ours.
The week's evidences of Anglo-American tension brought a warning, too, from Lewis Douglas, recently retired as our ambassador to the Court of St. James's.
Britain represents the last reliable bastion of strength between the Iron Curtain and our own shores. Our common philosophical and cultural heritage, the common belief in individual freedom, which in the United Kingdom is no less firmly held now than it used to be, make the strength of Britain as natural and important an addition to our own strength as ours is to theirs. And between the two, there exists a need for each other, far greater than at any time in history.
There was once an American ambassador to Great Britain who flatly refused to wear the traditional silk breeches to the court. This country was delighted when the late Charles G. Dawes said, "Hell and Moriah, he wouldn't consider wearing such a getup." Death came to General Dawes this week at the age of 85. Few Americans have won more honors in a lifetime. A lifetime that began for Vice President Dawes in Marietta, Ohio, the city he always remembered with affection.
In common with all the residents and ex-residents of Marietta, the thought comes to me that this little city here is the grandmother of all the cities in the five states of Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, and a part of Minnesota. That includes my adopted city, Chicago.
This was the man who made the upside-down pipe famous, who won the Nobel Peace Prize. And looking back through our archives this week, we came on some words of Charles Dawes, spoken on the eve of World War II, words with meaning for today.
The courage of a people is best tested during the great tragedy of war. But the best testing time of their wisdom, without which courage alone may be disastrous, is in time of peace, when the lessons of a war are reappraised. Our country has been great in war because Jews, Catholics, and Protestants in united citizenship marched shoulder to shoulder behind its flag in a common loyalty to American ideals.
You are listening to Voices and Events, the living record of the news of the past 7 days presented through new departures in radio journalism. And again, the editor of Voices and Events, James Fleming.
In 1947, Edward Dimitrik was one of the Hollywood Ten, one of the witnesses who refused to state to the House Un-American Activities Committee whether or not he was a communist. Edward Dimitrik went to jail. He served his term. And this week, the film director came back to that same committee.
Are you willing to cooperate with the committee and giving it the benefit of what knowledge you have from your own experiences, both while a member of the Communist Party and later?
I certainly am.
And that is true, notwithstanding you refused to testify before this committee in 1947.
Yes, it's true. The situation has somewhat changed.
Dimitrik has had lots of time to think. And world events of the past 3 years educated him to some things he never knew before. Why had he changed his mind about communism?
In the first place, I had never heard before 47. I had never heard anybody say that they would refuse to fight for this country in a war against Soviet Russia. I believe I was first in England when I saw an account of some Australian communist labor leaders who made that remark first. The next time I heard it, I was also in England, but it was reported from America. I believe Paul Robeson made that. Since that time at this hearing, we've had people who refused to state whether they would or would not fight in defense of their country. I think this is one of the basic things of democracy, that if you have a democracy, each citizen takes upon himself the duty to defend his country in time of war. Other things happened. Along with other people, I signed the Stockholm Peace Appeal. I believe in peace as everybody does. I at least hope that they were sincere. However, the Korean War made me realize that they were not. This, too, troubled me tremendously and has made me realize that that there is a communist menace.
Another witness this week was movie actor Mark Lawrence. Yes, he said he had been a communist, and he offered some rather colorful reasons for his party membership.
And these guys confused me. They gave me headaches, and they talked. And they kept telling me a lot of things like that. I didn't like the speeches because these things disturbed me. So I left after about 12 of these meetings. Following that, this must have been in about 1939. I left and had no connection at all with the Communist Party.
You stated that Lionel Stander was the one who introduced you into the Communist Party.
He's the guy that said to me, get to know this stuff and you make out more with the names. This is the guy that's... this is the introduction to the whole
idea. What was that he said to you?
You get to know the names more, you know, with the line. You know, I got confused after a great deal. You know, this stuff really confused me. I thought at first it was a good idea. I went to the thing because I thought that you could learn something. I never learned anything.
Actor Morris Karnofsky and writer Abraham Polonsky refused to answer the congressman's queries about Communist Party membership on the grounds of self-incrimination. Most famed of the week's witnesses was movie star John Garfield, who denied any Red affiliation.
Is it a fact that you have always hated communism?
Absolutely, yes. I think it's a subversive movement. And is a tyranny. And is a dictatorship. And is against democracy.
Have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I have never been a member of the Communist Party.
The committee asked Garfield about membership in communist fronts, the Young Communist League, for example.
I have no knowledge of lending my name to this organization, particularly an organization called the Young Communist League, because believe me, if I had heard of such a name, I would have run like hell.
And next week, more Hollywood names will have their turn. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we turn to a consideration of a subject that half the nation applauds enthusiastically, the other half ignores. This day, for most of us, is truly later than we think. The first day of daylight saving time. Yes, all conscientious householders involved have by now turned backward, oh backward, time in its flight. An hour of sleep was placed on deposit in the darkness of last night, an hour we won't recover until summer is gone. There's a lot or a little that you can say about time. We'll say just a little. It marches on, it waits for no man, it flies. Time is of the essence, time's a-wasting. And the rather jumpy, persistent, and cockeyed rhythm of the times we live in have just been captured in music by a brilliant young New England composer named Leroy Anderson. We give you, ladies and gentlemen, the syncopated clock.
Been listening to Voices and Events, this week's living record of history. James Fleming is the editor and narrator of Voices and Events. New techniques of reporting and recording pioneered by the NBC Newsroom make possible this first-hand account of the never-ending story that is the news. This is Robert Warren inviting you to listen next week at this same hour for the sounds and voices of the next 7 days, gathered by NBC correspondents all over the world. Listen for Voices and Events. Tonight's voices included General MacArthur, General Ridgway, the Duke of Windsor, Charles E. Wilson, and Robert Vogler. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.